very engaging diet. By way of that, yeah, it's an interesting introduction. Good evening, everybody. My name is Julie Diamond, and nice to have you here. And this is Vasiliki Katrivanu.
Katrivanu, yes, very nice to be with you.
And we're going to both do the lecture tonight. Originally, my name was originally on the lecture, but at the last minute,
you invited me.
I invited Vasiliki. That's how it happened.
Thank you very much.
Vasiliki has done some recently has done some very interesting work on facilitating public disputes in Cyprus. And so she's going to be talking about her experiences there as a way to illustrate what we'll be talking about tonight. So, yeah. Okay, nice to have everybody here. What I'm going to talk about tonight, I'll just give a little overview, is I'm going to talk about the role of public disputes and public conflict in developing democracy. How is that a part of or a challenge to democracy? What's the relationship between that? And we're going to talk specifically about how valuable public conflict can be towards developing democracy, and developing democracy, not just the institutional level of democracy, but the behavior of democracy, sort of the foundation of it. It's the vehicle, in a way. Conflict is a vehicle through which we learn, or could learn, democratic behaviors. I'm a little echoey. Is that possible to, that's better for me. How is that for everybody? Yeah. So public dispute, public conflict, not as the exception, but as the rule to a democratic society. And what does that mean? How can that be a part of creating democracy? And then really specifically, what are the skills? What are the so-called democratic arts that we need to facilitate conflict, facilitate dispute? And that Vasiliki will be talking there about the specific skills and experiences that you had in Cyprus and that you used in facilitating public forums on issues. So maybe you want to say a little bit about what you've done.
Well, just to put you on the same boat, what I did in Cyprus, I went in April 2004 when it was the time where the island is separated between the Turkish Cypriot community country and the Greek Cypriot democracy. So they're two separate countries. And after 30 years, they were going to vote on the Annan Plan, which suggested the reunification of the island. So, so it was a big moment in their history where after 30 years, it was like two separate countries. They couldn't communicate. The checkpoints were closed. The borders were closed. And they had the chance to vote yes or not for the reunification of the island. And for many different reasons, that's a very complicated situation. The majority of Greek Cypriot voted no for the Annan plan. They said, we voted no to the plan, not to the reunification. And the majority of the Turkish Cypriots voted yes for the plan. So, it was a big time on the island. So then I went to do a research on how nationalism intersects with gender relationships and do a documentary. And we did public discussions with women.
Both Turkish Cypriots
and Greek Cypriots, mixed groups, both before the referendum and after the referendum, to see how, to hear what women had to say, because they were so marginalized in the whole political discussion. It was very male dominant, the whole discussion. So to see what they had to say and how differently they could handle conflict. So generally that's the context or the frame where I went to.
It's interesting, you also have a documentary on that, which we won't be looking at tonight, but you'll be talking about it. So before we talk, we'll come back to Vasiliki's talking about her specific experiences there when we talk about the skills. And then first I want to introduce some of the concepts of public dispute, public dialogue, and its relationship to the democratic process, if that's of interest to you. If not, we're out of luck because that's what I prepared. So I could sort of change on the spot, but it would be a little hard. And it's something that I've spent a lot of time studying, so actually it's of interest to me at least. In looking at public dispute and public conflict, I see that as almost the stuff of democracy, that public disputes and public conflict could really be, in a way, a foundational political process. It's really how we get together, how we learn about each other, how we work out differences, and yet it occupies a very sort of marginal role in society. It's kind of like the exception. Disputes happen when people can't settle a difference, and then we have to focus on the disputes. And there's different reasons for that. One of the reasons is that we fail to see a connection between sort of democratic process and political conflict or public dispute is the whole volatility and emotionality that's a part of the conflict and public dispute. And here's an example. This was recorded during a high-level public dispute between two factions. One member of one faction said to the other, shut up, sit down and shut up, you pig. Why don't you shut up, you clown? And then later in the same session, these following slurs were recorded as how the people, these are very high-level people discussing together. And they called each other scumbags, pieces of criminal garbage, sleazebags, stupid, foul-mouthed grubs, pissants, mangy maggot, gutless spivs, boxheads, immoral cheats, and stunned mullets. And some of you may recognize some of the terminology here. This public dispute was in the Australian Parliament, and the person who yelled at his opponent, shut up and sit down, you pig, well, that was Paul Keating, the Prime Minister of Australia at the time. And we're laughing, it's funny, it's kind of almost relieving, you know, yes, to think of that. That's recorded in, some of you may know the writer Bill Bryson, the travel writer. He wrote about Australia, and that's one of the style, he says the style of public dispute and political dispute in Australia is very different from how we do it here, though I'm not so sure that's really true. We may sound a little different, but I think at the heart of it. What's that?
Similar degrees. Sometimes.
Similar degrees, yeah. And I think the ongoing tension in democracy is kind of a fear of inherent violence or emotionality or the unchecked hostility between factions and what could happen if it gets out of control. And even way early on, these were part of the original debates about forming the United States of America. In the well-known Federalist Papers, for example, a lot of it warned about factions, what happens, like pluralism is really a danger because there's just different factions want different things and how do they really get along and they need to be regulated. And also, what about just passions, people's emotions, and that people, there's just a tendency in human nature to be one-sided, to want your side at all costs, and the very foundation of democracy is that you lose. You cannot win all the time, you lose. But that there's this like little problem with human nature. We don't really like to lose all the time, and we want to win at all costs. Not all of us, I'm sort of speaking generally. And so this little issue, this little problem with human nature, the potential emotionality is therefore managed a lot. And if you look at how democracy's developed, it's developed as a system of managing the potential for chaos, or managing the potential for conflict to erupt and emerge and not be productive, but to be destructive. And so I would call this almost like a fearful democracy, like it's a democracy kind of fearful of, or skeptical, or even hostile towards full enfranchisement. And it's not just an enfranchisement of different peoples, but of different parts of people, like the emotionality. And that if we really bring our full selves in, things will get out of hand and be potentially violent and counterproductive. So public dispute, the political process, all of this is managed quite rigidly. Except, of course, then we see things like the Jerry Springer Show, where it's almost like we were allowed for a little moment to see the wild, raw underbelly of interaction, but we sort of look at it like it's kind of just entertainment. Them. It's them. And so in a sense, we've developed a system where at the heart of it is there's like an anxiety in the background. There's like a lot of anxiety about full participation. What would happen if we could really, would conflict, we can't really settle conflicts really well, or we try to, but there's a lot of anxiety about what people will do to each other. There's also a lot of anxiety about what governments will do to people. There's a lot of anxiety about what moneyed interests will do to citizens. There's like an anxiety about any one faction gaining an upper hand and getting dominance. And yeah, you have to use the microphone there for the recording, sorry, Katya. And flip the switch and then hold it close.
What do you mean by enfranchisement when you were talking about that earlier?
Well, what I meant by enfranchisement, well, originally enfranchisement means literally the right to vote, the right to participate, the right to be considered a full citizen with all the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. So, I mean, even early on, a lot of the women and African Americans weren't, and unpropertied citizens weren't given full enfranchisement. And the argument in the background was that they weren't rational enough. Mm-hmm. So you could even see in that the fear of irrationality, or like what was threatening to democracy was the possibility that passionate engagement, women were like irrational, or slaves or black people weren't capable of rational, or the uneducated masses who didn't have property, they weren't capable of participating in democracy. So that lack of full enfranchisement was there at the very beginning, and it's still there now in terms of how we feel about the whole person coming in to the political process. We're allowed to come in very rational, very constrained ways. When we moderate dialogue and debate, we typically do so in a way, we get people calm and then we discuss the issues. So, and I'm not saying that's wrong, I'm just saying there's a whole lot we don't know about emotions. I think, and I'll get to that in a minute, I think it's, we've developed procedures that work with partial enfranchisement, that sort of allow in the more rational parts of ourselves, really because we don't know how to manage anything else really well. We're beginning, we're developing it, but it's still kind of a new thing. Thanks for asking. So, in fact, early on, until the mid-19th century, the word Democrat was a pejorative, meaning it was an insult. It was a word that was used to put people like, that's, you know, he's a Democrat, or the Democratic rabble was a...
He's a communist later on or something.
Later on, he was a communist, right? It's like, they're just communists, or they're anarchists, but the word Democratic meant, you know, it was referred to the uneducated rabble, or the mm-hmm. masses, the people who weren't capable of self-government. And there was this whole thing that, like, to be capable of self-government, you needed to be educated or rational, and needed to be male, and this has changed. But there's still this flavor of fear of that potential, the emotionality in the background. And so that's why we've developed these procedures that protect us from people, from the government, from the people from the government, but really us from our emotions and from conflict and from what could happen if things got out of hand. And so as I just said, what we've developed is methods that manage human volatility. And in the background is really that we know very little about human consciousness, that one of the things that's exciting about conflict resolution as a field, mm-hmm. or public facilitation of public conflicts as a field, is that it brings us to the point of having to know more about human behavior and human consciousness, and it's putting together what we know in sociology and psychology and politics, and it's bringing it all together. Because it's not just the political process when people come together, it's not just about positions. Behind the positions are really deep-seated emotional issues and things that go to the very foundation of people's consciousness, things like identity, things like safety and security, threats to existence. And it's like hard to get people to, in public disputes and public conflict, to just be rational or to manage their emotions when such deep issues. I mean, just think about yourself. When you talk about your identity or the things that are most key to your being, you tend to get a little wobbly there. So if you think about 300 years of oppression or 100 years of having lost your land or ethnic cleansing or whatever, you're going to get a little wobbly too. And so just expect rational dialogue and debate over positions. And a lot of methods are now working at this level. I'm thinking about the multi-track diplomacy, which seeks to work with people and bringing people together. And of course, the model here that the deep democracy model is working with that. But a lot of the identity, looking at identity and conflict is now becoming more and more accepted. And yet still, if you look at the political process is still really operating on a very rational model. And interestingly enough, we're still in the Middle Ages, or we're still like in the Enlightenment phase. We're still using the same methods that we started using for the political process, we're still using today. Very little's changed. We've got new methods coming up on the margins. We've got, if you look, there's, you know, do a web search on this, you'll see a lot of interesting new methods coming up, but the dominant mainstream method of the political process and managing public interaction is still very much in this Enlightenment model. And if you compare it to medicine, for example, right, it's like if we were still using the same methods that we used in the 1800s for medicine, right, we'd be leeching ourselves, putting leeches. Well, we're doing that again now, aren't we?
Yeah.
Actually. back full circle. But we're not using the same medical or technological methods that we used in the mid-1800s, and yet, in a lot of ways, we're still using the same political processes that we used 200 years ago, and that hasn't really fully changed much. At least it hasn't yet been absorbed in the mainstream. So updating our methods, would be to embrace the public forum and public dispute and conflict and the emotionality as a foundation of civic participation, as the rule and not the exception. It's not what happens when things get derailed, but it's, oh, this is how we do politics. We come together, we discuss, we debate, and it can get emotional, and we need to hear from people. We need to hear from people and where they're coming from. This is really the stuff of politics. We need to hear about the feelings and the fears and the anxieties, and it's about you and me. It's about interaction. It's not just about political positions. So there's nothing wrong. I want to make sure I'm saying that there's also nothing wrong with rational participation, and the methods that we have are really good for certain things, and I'm glad we have them. They've enabled more participation than ever before, and they've done a lot of things, but the very rationality that enables participation in some ways also supplants it. It also marginalizes full participation in a lot of ways. If you just look at the voting percentages of voting, people feel very turned off by the political process. They go, where am I in the whole thing? I don't see myself.
Like in Cyprus, I asked some men, why do you think women are not participating? And they said, oh, well, first of all, they don't have the training, they don't have the education to do that. And also, they are not good with media. They can't just argue well, they become emotional. So what you're saying, it's like if we stay on the same track, we are going to keep marginalizing big segments of the
population. Everybody has different. One of the things about more full participation is to recognize the diversity of communication styles and conflict styles and political styles and participation styles. Like that example from Australia, in a sense, you could say, well, that's also a style, and that why not have a more free style like that, or emotional styles and rational styles, and every kind of style should be involved. And every country really has different styles, and I think that we'll see more and more flowering different ways of participating. I just want to say a little bit about the background of some of this ideas. I want to say there's actually a lineage behind this, several lineages, and I want to mention it, and then we'll talk more about the skills too. This idea of democracy being more more of a human enterprise, going from this more fearful democracy to a more robust participatory democracy. It's a whole person approach to democracy, and it's the essence of what we call deep democracy, what's called deep democracy, and it also, which we're going to talk about, and it also is, it's also found in the tradition of developmental democracy, which I just want to say a few words about, developmental democracy is a tradition in democracy that it sees democracy as it's not just a governmental process, it's not just a procedure of government, but it's actually a process of personal growth. And it's that's through the process of democracy, through the debates, through dialogue, through disputes, that we actually develop very key skills and abilities in ourselves, what I call like the democratic arts, which are, well, you could say it's emotional intelligence, it's relational intelligence, it's the ability to communicate, to interact, it's the ability to think about issues, to be pluralistic in our thinking, to hold diverse points of views, to argue about them, to accommodate, to take different sides, to change your mind, that there's all these different skills and abilities behind being democratic, and that democracy itself is needed in order to become a whole person. That's this. It's called developmental democracy. How many people know about the developmental? Have heard about the developmental democracy? So I could say something wrong, and I won't get. I have a little freedom here. Okay. One of the champions of developmental democracy was John Stuart Mill, in early on, and also Mary Wollstonecraft. Who wrote The Vindication of the Rights of Women. Does anybody remember? Does anybody remember her? Remember? Were you around back then in the 18th century? But what she argued for the rights of women, saying that you can't be a whole person without contributing to civic life. And this is that's the essence of developmental democracy. It says to really be a whole person, you can't just do your thing or work on yourself or have your own private life. You're a social being, and that you must participate in the civic life around you, and that makes you a whole person. So even the doing of democracy is itself also learning how to do democracy, and it's also developing you as you develop democracy. It's like a mutual developmental process. You're developing democracy, and it's developing you. This was also a little bit of developmental democracy was seen in the limited democracy of Athens, the Athenian democracy that some of you may be familiar with. They had a great antipathy towards voting. I don't know if you know that the Athenians, they did democracy limited. They had a slave culture, so, you know, women weren't, it wasn't a full enfranchisement. There's a lot of limitations to the democracy, but they did do one thing which was interesting, is that they didn't like voting. They felt that voting subverted the democratic process because it was a winner take all. It was a form of tyranny of numbers, that to vote was to marginalize the issue. That what they much preferred was public debate and forums, and that they would debate for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. One of the reasons why Plato wasn't a great big fan of democracy was because he felt that charisma could carry the day, that people could get up and speak, and they could sway each other with sort of their charismatic positions, and that it was, you know, people were being prone to sort of follow somebody just because they had a good argument. And yes, that is a danger, but that's, again, one of the things that we want to develop, that to really have a democracy, you have to be able to discern the arguments and debates and also the positions.
You see ancient Greek ruins, you can see like that the place where this debate was done,
right,
was like in the middle of the market.
Yeah.
So it was like very incorporated to the everyday life.
That's
and
right.
It was like it was whether you know I'm debating. It wasn't like politicians go to the parliament to debate.
That's right.
It was like
integrated
into the marketplace.
That's
you know?
Right. It was all. It was like every kind of transaction.
Yeah.
It was a political transaction.
Exactly.
It was like monetary transaction. It was food. It was meeting your neighbors, mm-hmm. catching up on gossip. And debating everything.
And it wasn't somewhere yeah. else, like yeah. outside of the where all the interactions,
right.
it was in the center
right
of where
the
interactions were happening. Yeah.
Funny, I just saw it.
Yeah.
It's right downtown. And
yeah, yeah.
And
it's downtown. Yeah.
And
the, yeah.
Right down. There's yeah. like a, there's cafes
yeah.
and then there's,
yeah.
it's
yeah.
really trippy, you know, to sort of see this is where
Black
all this happened.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, Killian, actually, you know, we're being taped and you're going to need a microphone if you can flip it on and.
Yeah. So, a little subject for debate, maybe. I'm just curious whether the Athenians ever had trouble with people buying debaters.
Buying debaters?
Buying debaters. We have trouble with lobbyists buying senators. Did they have trouble with somebody buying a debater? You know about that?
No. That would be, I'll put that down. That's something for me to research. That's good. Yeah.
I was studying classical Greek way a long time ago. basically,
I stumbled onto a hot topic here. Yeah.
They told me that the process of law in Athens was such like almost theater. So popularity played like a really big role. So the lawyers were like popularity, charismatic like characters, and they would be hired. You know, they would be bought. To like play up this big thing, and then the audience response to the whole thing was part of the process. Like if they really liked a guy or person, then they would tend to like. So it was that sort of thing.
Yeah,
that's
why
the information I got. You know.
That's why that's Plato. If you read Plato, railed against democracy. He really didn't like it for that very reason. He just felt that it appealed to the base passions of people, and then Plato developed his whole theory of, you know, the danger of being ruled by your passions, and that's why we need philosopher kings to rule, because they're more judicious, and they're not swayed by passions, and it's that, that's
or
right.
Or ethical, like, the all this, mm. anyway.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing.
But this debate is really interesting. This is the whole thing about passion and the role of passion and emotion in democracy. Can we really do it, or will people just be swayed by like the current fashion or their strong argument or their sense of safety or their need for this or that and their so-called base passions? And that's, I think, that's the tension in democracy. That's where we're at, and that's why we're saying that in order to really, that we'd like to be able to do that, and we need to know a lot more about human consciousness about all these the so-called soft skills, those so-called democratic arts, and you know, what is it to be a person and to participate. I want to say a few other people who I like in the developmental democracy vein, just because I want to evoke would mean I'd bring them here, right? Evoke. Right, right. That would be harder. I'll just invoke them. Okay. another lesser known champion of this type of democracy was a woman named Mary Parker Follett. Does anybody know her? She's like disappeared. It's really amazing. She wrote this unbelievable book, and those of you who are studying world work or the process work model taught here, be fascinated to know that she says the key to democracy is something, a method called group process. And she wrote this book called The New State in 1918, and she was a champion of the settlement movement, you know, that Jane Addams is often associated as the founder of that movement, where working in the inner city poverty areas, a lot of immigration happened in that time, and the settlement movement was a movement to educate people, adults. It was an adult education movement, but it was also like a community center movement to help educate people. And So she was a real champion of direct democracy, like really getting people engaged and involved. And she felt that democracy, this is, I'm going to give a quote of hers because it's really, it's quite accurate. She said, the study of democracy has been based largely on the study of institutions. It should be based on the study of how people behave together. We have to deal not with institutions or mechanical things or with abstract ideas, but with people, just ordinary people. That's the heart of democracy. And for her, the key to that also was an openness to diversity. And she wrote about diversity. This is 1918. And she says, instead of shutting out what is different, we should welcome it because it is different, and through its difference, we will make a richer content of life. Every difference that is swept up into a bigger conception feeds and enriches society. Every difference which is ignored feeds on society and eventually corrupts it. And so she felt that what for her the group process was giving people an open, unstructured forum to dialogue and to debate together. And through that, she says, they get to learn about difference and they learn about each other. And they teach each other through their difference. And in a sense, that's really the essence of our world work approach here, the same idea. And is that okay? Can I indulge my love of these people just a few more moments? Okay, so one more person who I think was an amazing champion, and I realize my interest or my knowledge is very biased towards because of who I am and where I come from. So it's a little American focused for starters, and it just reflects what I've studied and who I am. But another person was the poet and radical visionary Walt Whitman. He was a terrific champion of democracy, and he loved the multicultural, diverse cacophony of voices and cacophony, a noisy symphony. And he used to use the metaphor of symphony to discuss like how conflict was, the different melodies came together and created a really unique symphony, and that was democracy. And a lot of his poetry was really, you know, his love of the so-called democratic experiment. And finally, I just want to mention John Dewey, who one of my heroes. I really love John Dewey. John Dewey was a philosopher and educator and educational reformer in the early part of the our century's changed, and now I can't do it anymore. I used to be able to just rattle that off, and now I have to think. He was born in the 19th century. He did a lot of his writing in the 20th century, and he really felt that participating in political life was a form of individual self-development and a spiritual task. And he wrote a lot about how our educational systems need to really prepare people to participate democratically, and how the whole self-growth component of democracy was really underrepresented, and that democracy itself was the means for self-development. And of course, Arnie Mandel, the developer of deep democracy, this institute here that teaches and researches his work, has also written about this in his deep democracy. His term deep democracy, that the essence of democracy is really the whole person, the non-rational and not just the rational, and all the deep feelings and dreams and spiritual parts of people, and that if we don't let that in, that we're only having a very partial, very surface democracy. So democracy is more than just how we run things. It's not just like a management technique. It's really how we treat ourselves and how we treat others. And so, therefore, it's really a set of skills. It's really a set of skills. And so public dispute, public dialogue, to come back to that, that in a sense is the stuff of democracy. It's how we encounter each other. It's how we learn. It's how we learn about difference. It's how we learn about ourselves. And learning how to negotiate conflicting issues, divisive issues. This is the essence of what democracy really should be about. And so what does it take? This is what we're going to turn to now, and with the help of Vasiliki, we're going to talk about this. What does it really take to be, all right, to learn these skills for ourselves and also to facilitate? A lot of us here are interested in facilitating or participating in public disputes or conflict or public forum. And how do we, and the specific question we're going to answer here is how do we facilitate these in a way that we're not just resolving the issue, but that's great to resolve issues, but if we think our deeper task here is the educational process of like democracy as a vehicle for self-growth, so public dispute, how do we moderate public dispute in such a way that we learn democracy, that we grow in our skills, that we help people, that we are actually teaching at the same time, we're not just settling an issue. So, okay, we're gonna do this together, right? This is like a little.
We haven't tried.
We haven't. We're gonna sort of have a public dialogue here. Okay.
Thinking together.
We're thinking together.
Yeah.
So we worked together a little bit when Vasiliki came back from Cyprus.
Yeah, you helped me do my thesis.
We worked a little bit on some of that. So
we were thinking about this issue. That's why you told me to come. So now we're gonna think more.
Now we're gonna think about it with an audience together.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
That's gonna be good. And we're gonna talk probably for another 15 or 20 minutes or so, and then we'll have time for questions.
Okay.
Okay. So one of the skills that we talked about, and I'll say it and then you can give some more examples, is to go from being, it's an empowerment, it's a skill of empowering. And what we mean by that is that that participants in a conflict aren't just people in trouble, they're educators. In other words, anybody who suffered through anything is at the same time someone who can teach someone about what they've been through. And so people in conflict have a lot to teach other people. And as we facilitate conflict and public disputes, one way to do it is as a facilitator is to see people as educators, as teachers, as having wisdom. You've been through what you've been through and you have a lot to teach each other, and we're not just looking at you as unfortunate people who need help, but as teachers. And so that's an empowerment process, and you can say more about that.
I think I'm just gonna go on from what Julie says and try to think how it happened in my experience in Cyprus. So so what I did was like open forums where women, Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots, were talking about the referendum and their experience of being a woman and handle conflict. And because they were not part of the conversation in the media and in the on the panels and in the main political discussion, they felt marginalized. But coming to this, the fact that these forums were created was a form of empowering themselves, because they heard each other, they connected, and they acknowledged their power somehow, and their wisdom and how they went through the hardships or what they did or how smart they are or how like witty they are or everything. And this has to, and I think the role of the facilitator is crucial, because in the beginning, in every discussion where you talk about an issue that has conflict, you tend to feel like powerless. Either you're the victim of the other side or you're the victim of the conflict itself. Am I okay with this? So the facilitator just can help them notice how they handle situation, help the appreciation to happen, and the just admire and really hear and learn from the wisdom. So as a facilitator, you become more like they become the teachers, and you become like the student in the spot, and you really represent the role that it's missed, which is the one who appreciates and hears and learns, and also this way they experience their power that way also. Shall I go on, or?
Well, it makes me think about, you know, like if you go into a conflict situation somewhere, frequently you'll also be criticized as a facilitator for thinking that you know better.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a common experience that's happened to me, going in somewhere and people will say to you, what do you know? You're not from here. And that's like an implicit, it's not yet, but it's a potential teacher who's saying, I know better, I've survived this, you haven't, you've read a bunch of books, or you've been through a school program, or whatever you've done to learn your skills, but I'm the one living it. And so it makes me think that it wants to happen, that educator, that feeling of being an educator or feeling empowered wants to happen.
So you have to have it in mind that minimal intervention sometimes mm-hmm. is more useful than, you know, because they can do it. Mm-hmm. They are doing it in their everyday life. They deal with the conflict more than you do.
Mm-hmm.
They just need awareness how they do it and what's successful and what's problematic. Mm-hmm. I mean, but yeah.
That's so universal. It makes me remember when I facilitated conflict in the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia in the Balkans. We're laughing because Vasiliki's from Greece.
It's a whole issue.
And that's a very big issue in Greece when the country that I was in calls themselves Macedonia. But Greece, which is their neighbor, won't call them Macedonia. So
they call them Firom.
They call them Firom, FY, the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia, FYROM. And so we always have a joke about this because she's Greek and I have to be very careful what I say.
No, it's a certain nationalistic aspect which I don't
know. I'm teasing. I mean, it's not you. But
yeah, of course.
But right away, but right away going in there, and I think everybody who's ever gone into a conflict situation, you get tested right away. People will say, what do you know, and who are you, and where are you from? And, you know, we've been in this conflict for many, many years, and I don't think there's really anything you can do here, you know. And at first you feel like you're just not wanted, but if you see it as like a request.
If you say it's against you,
yeah.
If you take it personally, you lost the point. The point is see us.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
Yeah. How much we did and when, you know, how powerful we are. And identify, because they don't, mm-hmm. even they know it, they're so powerful. And if you see their presence, they're amazing, but they don't identify.
Right.
And they project it, like they project the power to the media, to the men, to the leadership, to everything else outside.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's right, that power becomes projected outside in a conflict situation.
Right.
But you could see it in the interactional signals, especially with you as the facilitator.
And then because you see it, how they stand, how they have like passion, how they take this, it's good to try to point it out and make them identify with the power in the interaction, in the moment, not just so that the conflict or the power just doesn't happen out there on a political scene, but it's happening in the moment. Everything happens in the moment. For example, and then it's between the interaction and how they engage with each other.
Mm-hmm.
The usual thing is that the one talks after the other and makes speeches. That's the primary thing, okay? And you are against or for something, and some were against the referendum, some were for the referendum, and it was just people were between getting bored or I've heard that, and you were thinking what you're going to say next, basically, okay? So if you try to see how the disagreement is happening between us in our interaction, and you focus on the interaction and in the role of the nationalist. Like, for example, you have something against nationalists, and somebody else brings something that is a nationalistic point of view, and then you interact with the nationalist mm-hmm. on the spot instead of just making speeches. Although people are afraid of the direct interaction because they think war is going to happen, actually, it is an empowering thing because you can embody the conflict that is happening out there and interact and do something on the spot.
Make change
on the spot. Yeah. And
you're actually. There's a second skill we were going to talk about, and you're sort of going into it. So let me just name it, and then we can. So the first skill we talked about was the sense of empowerment or empowering or remembering to see the power in the people who are in conflict and see the teaching in there. And then a way of empowerment, which mm-hmm. is now the second skill, is mm-hmm. also to help people complete interactions more directly as opposed to just kind of making speeches. Because in a public dispute, there's a lot of speech making.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of speech making going on. So you're saying, you're talking about helping people find in the room their opponent or have it out with somebody.
Have it out. It's very...
Finish an interaction.
Finish it. And, and have it out. You have it, like, on a personal level. Sometimes people get hurt, and just expressing their emotions is very important. And but then I'm just going like. But then also people. Then you give space for. You also give space as a facilitator for feelings and for personal stories. So people express where they're coming from. It's not like the political agenda that you hear in the media. Like there was this Greek woman, I remember, who was very standing against the referendum, that this we sold, that we will sell out our country and blah, blah, blah. And everybody was just like, oh, my God, she's going on again and again. And then somebody else asked her, like, so how come you say like that? Where are you coming from? Like something more. And she started saying, so this Greek woman, her parents grew up in Turkey, and they spoke Turkish, and all her identity was about a Greek growing up in Turkey. So when she came back to, she went to Greece and then to Cyprus, she had to defend herself that she's a real Greek and she's not a Turkish. So then she had like the slogan, you know, all the nationalist slogans, but all this history is in the background. So when you go there and you hear that, you stop defending your position, your political positions, and you go deeper where people are coming from. And this other woman, a Turkish Cypriot, was talking about how she became a refugee and how she was bombed and all her experience and how she was in enclaves for 20 years. They couldn't see the sea. And then you stop thinking about positions anymore. You feel the person, you think similar experiences. Then the Greeks said how they were refugees. So it stopped being like one against the other. Mm-hmm. It's like more of a sharing or of a ground, a different ground is created, and that deepens the interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also through that, the relationships and the atmosphere that's created, it's also empowering.
Mm-hmm.
Because they create something different on the spot. They change their feelings among each other, or they change their perceptions, or they say, I'm sorry, and then the other hearing, I'm sorry, changes momentarily the perception of history and trauma in the moment. I'm not talking, so it's a very, can be a very healing.
It's interesting that you bring up trauma and healing, because a lot of what's behind these speeches, a lot of what's behind these positions is really a long story of trauma. And so facilitation that can help people, what you're saying is help people go deeper, help people complete things, help people talk about where they're coming from, works a lot with the trauma experience.
And that's why, I mean, we discussed it also in the past, I remember, like, if you just make, if you just, for a referendum happens, for example, and it's just legal and institutional changes, but there's no space to process the trauma or to process history personally, it's not going to be sustainable.
Mm-hmm. I think we're finding that more and more. There's like a lot more work being done around historical trauma, and if a legal change does come in, there's still like hundreds of years or decades of ill will and stories and all kinds of things that need a space and need a forum to be heard. A couple other things I'll just say. The one other thing is to remember that under big issues are often hidden issues that need to come forward, that in facilitating a public forum or a public debate on a big topic, there's a lot of intersecting issues, you know, like you talked about in Cyprus, it's a conflict about nationalism, but there's gender issues, there's a huge class issue behind it, there's religious issues behind it, and that's true for just about every issue. but there's always going to be like a lot of other issues, and to make space or to name some of what the hidden issues might be. And
The nationalistic conflict, like, which goes on for like at least more than 30 years. 30 years there's after the war, so at least 50 years goes on. Represses any conversation around any other political or social conversation. So now that it was for people to vote, all the issues underneath that are connected, like the gender issues or class issues that interconnected with the nationalistic conflict, just pushed to come out. But the main attitude from the leadership is, we have to resolve the main conflict.
And we don't have time.
We don't have time to touch like women issues. And that's also by women. It's not like, you know, male. It's just the dominant perception. But then all the other, if you don't address the interconnected conflicts, you can't really resolve the big conflict. They're also interconnected. And it's the only way that women will feel, everybody will feel included. Like, some women were so bored of the thing that they were saying, I don't even care about this referendum. I just want, you know, you can't say that we don't have the skills or the education to be in the EU, women to be represented in the EU. So I want the new country, I want just women to be equal. So that's my issue. You know, they just go. So, yes, when there is a big issue and puts out the other issue pushed to come up, and that makes the situation more complex, but also creates more diversity in democracy.
Uh-huh. That's good.
Yeah.
It's also a big issue with social activism, I'm just thinking, too. Like, a certain group doesn't necessarily give time or see the connection of its issue to other issues.
Yeah.
So then it creates, like, a divisiveness, like a competition between groups for funding, for airtime, for participation from people, rather than feel like, we're all tied together. We are going to make it, or we're all not going to make it. In a way, it's
all we're going to make it, or none.
We're all
gonna make
no one's going to make it. Yeah. Another really big thing, just to come back to the facilitator skills that we're going to mention, is that if you're facilitating, or one of the facilitating a public conflict or a public forum, is to really get to the core feeling, get to the core issue in yourself. You know what I mean? Like, learning about the issue, knowing about the issue that you're going to facilitate is really important, but also to do your own personal work on it and really feel into that conflict for yourself and all the different feelings you have about it, so you can relate to people in their emotional space. They don't feel that you're just a detached facilitator. They feel that there's a, you're connection to the feelings makes them feel connected to their feelings, that there's room for them to be present in the debate.
I don't have much to say. I totally agree. And I was just, this can happen two ways. People can feel you, like, it's a feeling thing. They can feel you if you are with them, if you have been bothered, like, if this is a personal thing that, you know, you have troubled you, or you are just like a moderator of the discussion. They can just feel that. And also, many times they feel relieved when you say, when you speak personally and say how you got involved and why you are there. And like, I would speak about coming from Greece, being a woman, how I grew up with certain nationalistic slogans, being against Turks, and how for me it's important personally, although it's against the main mainstream theory around conflict resolution, which says you have to be neutral and you don't have to reveal your position or anything. I found the opposite, that it really engages people, and you're more transparent, people trust you more, and they're on board more with.
Of course, it depends on
how you do it,
and it depends on the type of conflict, but I think what you're saying is that people want to know that you're there for a personal reason.
Right.
And I remember when I was facilitating conflicts with labor union in the Balkans, right, there, even though I kept saying that I was a facilitator, I was a moderator, I was whatever I said, they kept calling me comrade. That, like, I would say a million times that I was that I wasn't from the labor union side of things. I was from the facilitation side of things, and I introduced myself and said where I was from, and it was like I never said a word. They just insisted on calling me comrade, and they insisted on seeing me as someone from the labor unions, because I think it was like they wanted to feel, this is, we need to know that you're engaged for an emotional reason. Yeah. And then we feel free to bring ourselves in. And then we can show you our conflicts on the inside. We won't show just a stranger our conflicts. So, yeah. I just want to, I noticed, we're going to wrap up. Is that good? Did you want to say more about?
I just was thinking that it's a big thing. Like, people get out this way, get out of their feeling marginalized or being in their houses, like this way, you know, in a private sphere, and just meeting together. It doesn't have to be like on the media, but create a space. You come out in a, you feel that you are participating in a public sphere and that you have a say, even though it doesn't matter how far it will go. You create on the spot, there is a process that you create, you have an impact on the spot, and that's empowering.
That's really good.
And that's what impressed me and make me like really appreciating the process.
I think that's a key thing. I'm glad you say that at the end, that the key to the whole thing is, why is this important for democracy, and what is the role of public disputes and public conflict? Democracy is that people feel they have an impact,
yeah,
that they're making a statement, they're affecting a change, even if it's a change in someone's perception,
yeah,
even if it's a change in an atmosphere in a room,
mm-hmm,
they're making a change, and that's a really big thing,
mm-hmm,
and that's really huge. And that to go back to this fear, you know, mm-hmm, the fear of what will happen if people bring
right
things out or interact more directly, I'm reminded of a study that was done. Pierre, you might know about this. There was a study done on medical litigation, when doctors make mistakes, and they discovered that the lawyers say that if doctors admit wrongdoing, it increases the chances of a lawsuit because they've admitted something, so now they're open to being sued. And the study found that if doctors admitted wrongdoing, it decreased the incidence, the likelihood of lawsuits, because people felt heard,
mm-hmm,
and people felt that a personal contact was made. So it just reminds me to go, this whole idea of like the fear of intimacy, the fear of emotionality and conflict. Yeah, it can be scary, and yes, without skills, it's too difficult to handle. But I think people feeling that they're heard, that they make an impact, can also potentially decrease just this more, you know, escalating legal conflict. And finally, not all of us are facilitators. Not all of us are facilitators. Not all of us participate like that in a venue. But how, as participants, as observers, can we also facilitate in this way? And the one thing that I just, to come back to this developmental idea thing that moves me so much, is to bring out the learner in you. That I think that's often missing in the public forum, is that we're constantly learning by what we're watching and what we're seeing. And when we see people in conflict, we're actually learning. And so to bring out the learner and tell people what you're learning, tell people what you've gotten from the conflict, or how their conflict has helped you with something, or what you'll mm-hmm do differently, or what mm-hmm will change in you. And I think that representing the learner, mm-hmm, it's almost like also seeing the teacher and the
mm-hmm
person,
mm-hmm,
bring out the learner in you, I think, is a step towards this developmental mm-hmm democracy idea.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's much more engaging.
It's more engaging,
yeah, yeah.
And that's what we're all about anyway.
Yeah.
We're the few species that can learn in a single lifespan without dying. Isn't that right? We get the opportunity to make mistakes and learn and keep going. Most species, you make a mistake and you don't pass on
it's
your genes.
Possible.
Yeah, right. We get a few chances. All right, we'll leave the floor open for questions for a few moments, and I'm going to be around for a few minutes afterwards, maybe Vasiliki too, to talk about our programs that we have for facilitating public conflict and public forums. So, but there's mics here. If anybody has any questions or comments, Pierre.
I was really fascinated about part of, you know, marginalizing the emotional interaction, and how that is happening on the internet now too. I don't know if, you know, with blogs, just yesterday I heard news that the Washington Post on their blog site was overwhelmed with thousands and thousands of comments and blogs and had to shut down their blog site because the comments were anonymous and were degrading.
Uh-huh.
So, and there's a tendency now on the internet that if you can be anonymous and if you can or make a statement as if someone else, things come out much stronger and much more violent.
Yeah.
or even, you know, degrading and things. So, and how that is, in a way, the internet something that is open for more democratic participation, but then comes up with the same problem, how to deal with this emotional interaction, and nobody really knows. They had just to shut down the blog site because they were overwhelmed.
That's a really big, that's a good point about the anonymity. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's always kept people in check is that you have to go out in the streets the next day and be seen by your neighbor. And some websites do this, by the way, like they have, you have to register to participate, and then your posts are reviewed by, like Slash.com does that. They review posts, and then they, and everybody has to take a turn being a reviewer. It's like Athenian democracy. So, yeah, the anonymity of the website and using pseudonyms and that is, yeah.
I'm just thinking when I work with teenagers sometimes, and I have stuffed animals, and the stuffed animals say everything that nobody can say, and they take it, and we were doing it together, actually. So it's something freeing to, because the issues are there in the field, but nobody wants to be the one who will bring it out. So other ways, this is like a way, indirect way where the...
Right. What's missing there, yeah, is processing it further.
Right.
For example, if the Washington Post or if a public blog place like that could
right,
represent the different, for example,
create a container.
Exactly. Container. Not just posts indiscriminately, mm-hmm, right? But to say, here are the various different positions that we've been seeing, or something, or reflect back to people. That would be interesting to, yeah, show people that. I'm not sure I know the. Mm-hmm.
One is the different contents, but then also really the communication style and the emotion and the depth of emotions and violence that can come out in people when they have suddenly the forum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the anonymity plays a big role,
mm-hmm,
because they don't have to feel responsible for it,
right,
but then how to deal with that.
Well, what's missing in that forum is a facilitator. I think that's the thing. There's nothing wrong necessarily.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like to be flamed. I mean, you know what I mean? I don't think, but what's missing in that particular,
mm-hmm,
form is that no one's facilitating it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big dumping ground for people to say anything.
Right.
That's,
yeah,
not quite yet a public forum.
Mm-hmm.
That's a graffiti wall.
Right.
Adding a facilitator would make that a forum.
Yeah.
How that happens, that's great. Yeah. Killing.
Thanks, Pierre.
Yeah, I think what you say is good, Julie, adding a facilitator, and part of what that does is it begins to create a listener. What's missing on those internet sites, in part, is a listener. So there may be different reasons why people say such extreme things, but one reason could be is that the listener, too, is anonymous. So one has to really say something extreme in an attempt to be heard.
That's a form. That's good, Killian. That's a form of facilitating, is to say, I heard you.
Yeah.
Did you really mean to eviscerate me, or was there a point in, you know, to really respond to it? The responder is facilitation. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, escalation. You said escalation happens when there's no response, when someone just keeps going. They don't feel they made their point. Yeah. Anybody else have a
question? Or?
Just thinking on that point, that in group process, in the process work community, it seems like anonymity is also somehow valuable to get things going.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have anonymity in the same way, mm-hmm. but we create roles that mm-hmm. people can then just step into and speak from mm-hmm. and go back and forth on different sides until it's held down mm-hmm. more personally. So it seems like there's something valuable to the anonymity.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Roles being an anonymous vehicle. Also, certain contexts don't have a lot of permission to speak openly, or there'll be retribution.
Yeah.
So you want to use, you could have people write anonymous things and give them to a facilitator, and the facilitator can represent the various positions. So you also, just the sensitivity to the different contexts in which mm-hmm. we facilitate.
Mm-hmm.
In some places it's dangerous for people to be known or mm-hmm. seen or heard, mm-hmm. and they could jeopardize their job. Like yeah. In a business, people, there's different levels, like there's management and staff doesn't feel comfortable, you know, saying everything in front of management. It's like mm-hmm. a problem. So you want to create, so anonymity is also valuable. It's valuable as long as there's a facilitator who can help people interact and engage with the different positions that come up. I think that's the key.
And it's part of the face of the discussion, I think. Like in the beginning, maybe anonymity is useful for issues to come out
mm-hmm.
and a certain protection. And then maybe there's another state where people become more personal mm-hmm. or stand for.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I'm remembering a fairly communist in Greece, they were making magazines anonymous, and that's the word protection. And then when communist was stopped to be illegal, it was a big thing that they would write their names underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
a phase.
It's a phase. It's mm-hmm. anything. I mean, I'm thinking that people have a lot. Maybe they have a lot of experience by what they were doing, but. What their interest is, or they're struggling around this issue, anything that can be relevant to it. Anyone share?
Question.
Mike. Last, we'll take Killian's question, and then we'll stop, and we can also we'll mingle here for a little bit if people want to talk more one-to-one.
Well, what we're talking about, the anger, sometimes put downs, reminds me of what would be hardest if I were facilitating a forum. And if somebody criticizes me, that moment
mm-hmm.
is a very difficult moment. You already pointed to one possible response, which is to say that's an emerging teacher. But I'd like to hear more about that. How to handle that moment, how to work on oneself, what to do with that moment when you as a facilitator are attacked.
Well, I only facilitate situations where I won't be attacked.
That's smart.
Being attacked as a facilitator is one of the nastiest experiences you could go through. It's not, I mean, how many people have been attacked in a facilitation role? How many people actively avoid being attacked in the facilitation role? Maybe you can say some things.
Well, sometimes, well, just thinking, like as we brainstorm, sometimes I try, if I have enough skills in the moment and, you know, detachment, to see what they're really trying to tell me. And not to take it as they don't know me from before. So it's not that they have a personal issue. So there must be like something in the field that has to be addressed, or they try really to tell me something, or they show their leadership. So I'm trying in the beginning not to take it personally, as it's not against me as Vasiliki, and see how I can make it useful. And that's what comes to my mind.
That's the first thing I do, too, is Killian. I try to remember it's not personal. I start talking to myself very rapidly, really rapidly.
Take it easy, girl.
Talk myself down, you know. But one of the things I say is it's not personal. because people don't know me, it's not against me. And even if it's against the facilitation method or what am I doing and this and that,
or the role,
I think to myself, it must be part of the whole conflict. Yeah. And so I try to see how that must be part of the whole conflict there. And it really does depend on the type of attack. Like I used to think, I had a recent realization and I thought to myself, wow, I hardly get attacked anymore. I said this to somebody recently. I said, wow, I hardly get attacked anymore. Isn't that amazing? And then I realized, I was teaching somewhere and someone came up to me and they said, boy, you handled that attack really well. And I said, I got attacked? Well, who attacked me? I said, that was an attack? And then I said, oh, I feel terrible. Was that an attack? And then I realized that it's not that I don't get attacked anymore.
Don't consider that.
But I don't consider things attacks anymore, that I used to consider things more of an attack. So I think the concept of attack is really sometimes people are upset and they're angry. Sometimes you represent a role or something. Sometimes people have a teaching they want to bring out. So there's all kinds of things in there about what really constitutes an attack. And what helps you the most with that is, I mean, this is just, it's like a, that is a developmental process. Remembering it's not personal. Defending yourself might be called for in a given moment. Having a co-facilitator, depending on the type of place you're going to, you may very well want to bring a co-facilitator. So if you do get attacked, you can step out and cool down or do whatever you need to do and have someone else there.
But also, most of the times, also preparing before going into, like, you dream, like, oh my God, this nasty person will attack me for that reason. Like, I was dreaming that I'm Greek and I'm going to Cyprus. The fact that I'm Greek, it isn't personal, it will provoke attacks. So you try to work before, like, identify and work before. I think it's useful.
That's really helpful. Yeah, I always work on... you always think ahead of time,
right,
who's going to attack you. You're like obsessed. You're obsessed with the fear of how you're going to get attacked. And really act that out with a friend or do it like a little inner work, inner dialogue, and attack yourself and figure out what you're attacking and then how to defend yourself and how to prepare, because the worst attack...
Without putting the other down, if you can.
Without putting the other down. Figure out why are you... Why should you be attacked?
Right.
What do you need to wake up to?
Right.
And how can you defend yourself? And what's right about the attacker? And knowing, like, for example, Arnie always says this too, that the worst attacks are the ones you're not prepared for.
Right.
If you're caught by surprise by an attack, it's just much more dreadful than being attacked for something you already hate yourself for. You like, oh, I know that. I'm on your side. I don't. You know what I mean? And if you already know yourself a little bit, it's like a lot easier to. I didn't mean hate yourself. You know what I meant? You already know that about yourself, and you're at peace with it.
I mean, that connects also, like the bias that I have as a facilitator. That's my weak point. Like, you know.
You get attacked.
And that's the place I'm going to get attacked. Like, I know that I have certain bias. I like this part, this group, and I don't like so much the other group. And if I don't work on my biases and I'm not fluid, I'm going to get back. And,
that's
yeah.
That's another good point.
Yeah.
That's good. Pierre. Yeah. You're doing a public forum.
Yes.
Is that what
cool.
you're going
to
announce?
I wanted to say yeah. instead of doing a public forum.
Right, nice.
On February 7th, I think it's a Saturday.
Uh-huh.
It's on inequality in health, and it's going to be here at 7 to 9:30. Just wanted to announce.
So
that.
All the skills.
And this flyers outside.
Oh, okay. So outside, I'm going to write it on the board.
Cool.
And all the skills we've talked about here, we'll be able to see in action
February 7th.
On health inequality. Inequality.
In
the health system.
In health system.
Oh,
great. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And we'll close up. Did you have a question?
Yeah. It's just, is there time?
Last for you. There's time.
Well, part of coming here, I wanted to hear some discussion about, so here we are, students learning, trying to learn how to bring open forums into our communities, and that we're really learning to do that So sort of brainstorming about the new is the right word, areas to go to, places to say, hey, would you like to study this with me, and let's try and create some open forum. And I mean, just to brainstorm, you're talking about educating mm-hmm. people to be deeply democratic. So how do we go about doing that, bring open forum working so people know about this, that they can, you know, how do we start beating the bushes? And
that's an open question for everybody to brainstorm about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do you do that? How do you go about, you know, you talk with friends, put up flyers, have open discussions? Do you have an idea?
Well, try to find key people that have connections with organizations or with groups and relate, and this will reconnect you with other groups and the whole thing. But I think also seeing a need, a specific need, not just say, you know, like that something needs to be discussed. Like in Cyprus they came not because I had beautiful eyes, as we say in Greece, but because the women... Women were not part of the discussion in the media, so they heard discussion, women only, they came, and it happened in 3 days. So find something that has juice in the moment. You know?
I especially liked what you said about the empowerment. It doesn't have to be a big thing, but just that people are talking and engaging, even in small things, is empowering and is educating. I think that was wonderful there, Zaliki.
Also, I just want to say also, I think that the topic that's nearest and dearest to your heart is the one to start with.
Okay.
You'll be most easiest, you'll be able to create something yeah. most easily when you have a lot of passion behind it, a lot of feelings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Thanks, Vasily. Thank you. Thank you for bringing in your experiences.
Thank you. We'll take the guns.
Now we can take off our Madonna.